So let's cultivate our motivation. And if we can stop the perpetual commentary in our mind about why are people doing this and why don't they do that, and it should be done this way and it shouldn't be done that way, and why are they doing this and what's going on, and you know, all of our internal commentary about even one small thing. What do they expect of me? What am I supposed to do? How come they're putting me in this position? If we can stop all of that, then we can just look at sentient beings and see that they're running around propelled by their afflictions, not really knowing what they're doing, trying to be happy, but in confusion, just going in circles or creating the cause for their own suffering. So if we take away all the inner chatter, we can see what the actual situation in samsara is, for ourselves and for others. And with that, generate compassion and the aspiration for freedom for ourselves and for everybody else as well. Because that's the only natural thing to think about or do upon seeing the actual situation of samsara. So you might try that sometimes and use it as a way to generate compassion, and from compassion, bodhicitta. And so may that be our intention for sharing the Dharma this evening. So, I want to recap what the proposal I received from the group, okay? And from what I understood, you got together after last week's... the teaching that didn't happen, or maybe the teaching that did happen, and decided that what you really need is more practice using what you've learned and going over it again and again and again and practicing it. And so with teachings, you know, that are streamed just once a week, that's very difficult to get that kind of practice that you need. And we can really see why at the beginning. Daniel Perdue, in the very beginning, he said, you got to get a partner and practice everything on a regular basis, so we can really see that. So the decision was made, since I'm leaving the day after tomorrow for 5 weeks. Next Thursday is Thanksgiving, and people here will be doing Nune, so there won't be any class. And then after that, there's 4 more classes before the new year. And that your plan is to divide the four classes among different people and go over the material. But since most of the material in the remaining pages in the book are the debates, yeah, that it should be fairly easy, because most of what you have to do in any case is practice the debates. Yeah. And so then, as I understood it, headed by Venerable Sepel, with Venerable Tarpa and Venerable Lamsa Sel assisting, then you'll have the class on the four Thursdays after next week, but it will not be streamed because it's too difficult to actually practice and pass around the microphone so that everybody can hear. And it's just a practice session anyway. So really encouraging the people who are on live stream to do your own practice sessions. Go over the rest of the material yourself and then practice the debates in them and make up more examples yourself. So you'll have those four sessions here that won't be streamed. And then you're going to have another practice session each week. Yeah. And then you're also contemplating having maybe a weekend where you really practice the debates quite intensely. And that will conclude the debate book and the debate course. Okay. And then during retreat, since I'm already teaching Vinaya and doing Friday night, and then also doing some BBCs, then there won't be another evening class. Yeah. And then after retreat, I'll teach Shanti Deva's text, and we need to talk a little bit about when that will be. It probably will not be a live streamed class. You know, because the evening isn't the best time for teachings, yeah. And so to figure out what a better time for teaching is, we'll of course tape the class, and all that will go on the archive, so people can certainly listen and so on and follow the course. That's no problem for people. So did I understand correctly what? Okay, good. And if you find out while you're doing it in the next month, because it's nice in December, there's not so much happening here, and so you'll be really, you know, you'll be able to really get into it. If by some chance you don't have enough time to really finish it, because it does involve a lot of practice, then you can also keep doing that as we go into retreat. You know, if you can just get the basic structure and an idea of this, it can be very helpful to you in your studies as well as in your life. And the present chapter that we've been doing, people seem to be very befuddled by it, but actually it's just going over what we learned at the very beginning about how to compare two phenomena. That's basically what the chapter is, you know, and it's just presented in another way that, like, okay, you're discussing with somebody, and the way they're talking, it seems like they think these two things relate as 3P, but you think they relate as 4P, so how are you going to talk to them and show them your position? Or you think they're MX, so what do you do? Or you think they're MI, and what do? You know? And so it's just going over that, all of that stuff about, you know, how do we compare phenomena, which is very, very helpful, yeah? And we think of these kinds of things all the time. And one of you, I printed out the sheet that you did. Do you have it on your computer? Can you put it up here? I printed it out and then I forgot it. The email, yeah. Okay. So while she's doing that, I was thinking of one example that we see very clearly in like the political situation. You know, people will say all beep are rapists and criminals. Yeah? You know, to people just make that kind of statement. You know, all so-and-so, whatever group they don't like, they're rapists and criminals. Okay. So how is that person seeing it? In what kind of way? Yeah, they're seeing, you know, rapists and, well, are they? How are they comparing? What are the two things they're comparing? Okay, so immigrants, let's say, and rapists and criminals. So how are they thinking that the two compare? Okay, you say, am I? Okay, so if they're am I, then an American citizen who is a rapist is an immigrant. No, she says the two things, racist, rapist and criminal. Let's just say criminal and immigrant. She says they're MI. So MI means that whatever is one is the other, and whatever is this one is that one. So I say to her, in that case, an American citizen who is a criminal is also an immigrant. Okay, what am I doing? I'm giving a consequence, yeah. And then what happens to you?
Then I stop and think that's an unwanted consequence because it does not reflect what they're actually saying.
Mm-hmm. So what is it, how is it that they're really saying it? Are they thinking that they're MI, or what do you think, how are they thinking of it?
So they're probably thinking that it's 3P.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Okay, so they're thinking that it's 3P.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and what do you think it is?
I think it's some are and some aren't, so 4P.
4P, okay. Yeah, so she thinks it's 3P.
Mm-hmm.
You think it's 4P.
Mm-hmm. I think it's 4P, but they thought it was 3P.
No, but I'm just for the sake of debate, I'm changing your view. Okay. Yeah. Okay, so you think it's 3P. She thinks it's 4P. Mm. So what are you going to do? You know, what's the problem? What is she seeing?
So she's not seeing. So she's not seeing that there is at least one P that is also a Q.
Okay, so put it in terms of this example.
So she's not seeing that there is at least one rapist and criminal that is not an immigrant.
Mm-hmm. And what else is she not seeing?
And she's not seeing that there are also some immigrants that are not rapists and criminals.
Right. Okay. Mm-hmm. So there's two things she's not seeing.
Yeah.
He only presents it as one thing, mm-hmm. but it's actually
both things.
Oh yeah, if he thinks it's 3 and you think it's 4. Okay, so then what are you going to do to talk to her?
So I will have to ask her to give an example of, let's see, if all immigrants are rapists. So to think an example of an immigrant that's not a rapist or a criminal.
Mm-hmm.
For example, Melania Trump.
Okay. So what you would do is you wouldn't ask her for that, mm-hmm. but you would tell her that. You would say, no, there is an immigrant who's not.
Yes.
Yeah.
a rapist and a criminal, for example, the subject Melania Trump.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you're saying no, that's not working. Why not?
Because for 3P, it would be all immigrants as the biggest circle and rapists in the middle. So I acknowledge that there are some immigrants.
No, it's the other way around. Because they're saying that all immigrants are rapists and criminals. So you would have the bigger circle would be rapists and criminals, which pervades immigrants.
Okay,
so that's how the pervasion goes.
Yeah, no, somebody's going, okay, so I'm a bigot, yeah? And I say, all these immigrants are racist, are criminals. Rapists and criminals. So I'm seeing it 3P, but which is the big circle and which is the small circle? All these immigrants are rapists and criminals.
Okay.
The big circle is the rapists and criminals. The small circle is the immigrants. Okay. So she just gave you the example of an immigrant who's not a rapist and a criminal, as far as we know, but they may be having another trial, you know. Huh?
There may be another, a second impeachment.
Yeah, right. So, okay, so you could explain to her, you know,
yes.
Or you could throw the consequence and say, oh, then Melania Trump must be a rapist
and a criminal. Yeah, because she's an immigrant.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, so that's basically what this whole chapter is about, is just looking at how different people see things and, you know, and this one, this is a very good example. The one we just did for when people are prejudiced against a whole group. Yeah, they're comparing two things as if they're 3P when they're actually 4P. Yeah. So, you know, whenever we, even sometimes with our self-talk, when we say all or never or something like that, yeah. We're thinking 3P when usually things are 4P.
This is the next section, and I mentioned to Venerable that when we were on the way to Tim's, the architect, she talked about her surprise hearing about JFK's involvement with sending troops into the Vietnam War, even though he knew it couldn't be won. So I wonder if that was a case of thinking that presidents and unethical people are 4P, but actually they are 3P, or maybe we could say presidents as a subset of people with unethical behavior. Yeah. So that includes maybe even JFK and Obama, because it's the nature of being a president.
Okay. Then His Holiness the Dalai Lama is also an unethical person because he's the head of a government.
I accept.
Or was.
That's why he gave up the position.
So he was an unethical person while he was head of the government.
I don't know what he had to do. No, but I guess so. He freed prisoners, yeah? He did his best to be ethical. Yeah.
Can you think of something unethical that His Holiness did while he was head of the government?
It follows that he would have kept the position if it was going to be beneficial, no? For him to be in that position.
Yeah, so is the only reason that he quit the position because it was unethical? What reason did he give when he left, when he retired from that?
I don't know, to establish democracy, which I don't believe in necessarily. But so he felt it would be better for the Tibetan people to have a democracy.
Yeah, that's not actually the reason he gave. That is one reason. Uh-huh. That is one reason. But the reason he gave is that he was getting older and he wanted to pay more attention to his practice.
I see.
And he wanted the Tibetans to have more practice with democracy. So are you saying that His Holiness Dalai Lama was an unethical person because he was a leader of a government?
No. Okay, so 4P, one example. No, but he did not retaliate under violence, it's true. Oh, American presidents.
No, I just was giving the example. And he wasn't a president, I was leader of the government, I said, you know. So she thought that I was thinking. What did you think I was thinking?
I was just interested in the surprise, right? That you were surprised that there were presidents that you thought were ethical, I don't know. Yeah, I thought you thought someone like JFK was ethical, but it turned out he was sending troops into a war that could not be won.
No, I wasn't thinking that JFK was 100% ethical. Yeah, it was just the one situation of him, you know, going along with the war and sending troops that, you know, I didn't know about before, that I didn't think was very smart, okay? But it was, you're assuming that I thought he was 100% ethical. Yeah, but, you know, who was he? Marilyn Monroe was his girlfriend, yeah?
Among others.
Yeah. Yeah? And, you know, there's lots of things going on that weren't so good. Okay. So you had a false imputation on me. Okay, then go on to the next one.
If you think it's 4P, but it's actually MX, so one example might be ordinary sentient beings and reliable sources of refuge. Mm-hmm. But you suffer if you imagine there's something that is both.
Okay, so somebody is thinking that ordinary sentient beings and reliable sources of refuge are 4P. Okay? And you say, and you think that they are MX. Okay? So then a bodhisattva on the path of preparation on the level of supreme dharma is not a reliable refuge.
I knew that was coming. I just wondered if they were ordinary, though. I
mean, yeah. They aren't Aryas yet, but they're almost Aryas. But according to what you say, they're not reliable. What does reliable mean? Do you have to? Yeah, they're still ordinary beings at that point. But they're right before becoming an Arya.
So are they the Sangha? They're not the ultimate Sangha refuge, though.
No, you have to be an Arya to be a Sangha jewel. But
could you say that
they're really close?
As an assembly of four fully ordained monks or nuns that are representative of the Sangha jewel. They're ordinary beings. Could they be a reliable source of refuge?
Well, what do you think?
Depends how we define reliable, but to a certain extent, yes.
I would say that they represent it, but they aren't it.
Yeah. What do other people think?
Number four increases the possibility that there's an ayah under the Sangha.
Okay, but you don't know that if you
no,
have
No, we don't
four.
Know that.
No. So a group of four of us, you know, we don't know. Maybe there's an ayah here. I don't know. Yeah. Are we a reliable four of us, a reliable source of refuge?
No.
What? Yeah, it's representative of the Sangha jewel, but to be, you know, a real reliable refuge, you have to be an Arya.
The Sangha members are more reliable than other ordinary sentient beings.
Yes, that's true. But are they a reliable source of refuge? Yeah. What? For ordinary Sangha members? So that means that maybe it's a debatable, means maybe they are. You're saying undecided. I'm asking.
Given some of the cases that we hear about mm-hmm. Sangha members behaving in an unreliable manner, mm-hmm. that it's not 100% established mm-hmm. that four Sangha members are more reliable than ordinary beings.
Mm-hmm. Well, Sangha members just means people wearing robes. Okay. So. Okay. Then, next one.
As if 4P, but actually, am I? Actually, I thought of an example later.
Okay.
Strangers and people who are kind to you. As if 4P, but you're training to see them as am I.
What do you think? Okay, so somebody thinks they're 4P. Okay, so somebody thinks they're 4P, and you've been training a long time, and you think they're MI. So what are you going to say to that person? Give an example of a stranger who isn't kind. Who has never been kind. Well, there's got to be one. Yeah? Is it really possible that we've known everybody? And that everybody's been kind? Couldn't there be one exception? Yeah, but you have to use reasoning. Okay. So I'm somebody who hasn't practiced Dharma, so name a stranger who isn't kind. The guy who wrecked my car. Yeah, who did... Yeah, but I don't want to practice patience. I want my car to work.
Yeah, well, maybe you did some kindness before that.
Yeah. Yeah, like what?
Tried to not hit a woman in the street and he hit your car.
Yeah, it's possible. Yeah, he swerved so he didn't have to hit somebody in the street, and instead he hit my car. Okay. Then? Did we go through all of them? We did.
This was the last week because you were talking about how we like to think spiritual teachers and ethical people are MI,
uh-huh.
right? But probably they are 4P. When you discover the spiritual teacher who is not ethical, it comes as a big shock.
What makes somebody a spiritual teacher? What's the definition of spiritual teacher that you're using here? Just somebody who has that title?
Yeah, I guess, or teaches a discipline that is spiritual. What's the definition of spiritual? Like, you know, there's the whole thing recently about yoga teachers and inappropriate behavior as well. And
uh-huh.
So people have certain expectations of their yoga teachers
uh-huh.
that they would be behaving in an ethical way toward mm-hmm. their students. Right?
Mm-hmm. So isn't that the one of people thinking that they're 3P, but they're actually 4P?
Oh, I see what you mean. Yes, yes.
To the first one, I just wonder what you think about governors of states mm-hmm. that have the death penalty and ethical people.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's an interesting one because they have to follow the law.
Yeah.
And they have to follow the law.
Okay. So you're comparing governors and
governors of states who have capital punishment?
One's a person and one's a state.
Governors of states who have capital punishment.
And
the other one is an ethical person.
Okay, so you're comparing ethical people and governors of states that have capital punishment. Okay, so what are they? Go through the four. First, is there something that is both an ethical person and a governor of a state with capital punishment?
Yeah, that's the crux of it, is there? If you think of ethical in the sense of we think of moral rather than just following the law, they are following the law by doing that, but is that ethical?
So what do you think?
I would say no.
Yeah, ethical means moral. No. It doesn't mean legal.
Right. So then this is the way I would say it.
Okay.
So then something that is a governor who is of a state that has the death penalty but is not ethical would be I think they have governor of Oklahoma or Texas because they have the death penalty in both those states.
Okay.
And somebody who is an ethical person but not a governor would be His Holiness.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody, something that is neither would be...
Maitri.
Could be the judge. They have to follow the law, too. Could be a person in a court case. A plaintiff in a court case.
Mm-hmm. Okay. But then... What about that first one? Is there somebody who's both an ethical person and a governor of?
I would say no.
There is.
Okay.
The subject, and I'm not sure the name I can pull out, it might have been even our governor, who, using the authority of his office, declared a cease to death penalty executions during the time of his or her governance. Mm-hmm.
So does that make that person an ethical person?
No, only compared to the question.
Does it make them an ethical person?
No.
Only on that issue. But that doesn't make them an ethical person. So we have to be quite specific about what we're comparing. Yeah.
Maybe not necessarily even on that issue, because that person might have done that as a result of some undue influence from a very big money donor who wanted to save a family member who was on death row.
What
the thing is there anyone? There could be someone who is ethical.
Yeah, there could be, but could you don't?
You have one who's both.
You have, when you're comparing things, you have to give actual examples. You can't give could be's.
So, you say okay.
What's your definition of an ethical person?
Well, what do you think?
I'm asking you.
My definition. Well, why are you asking me?
Well, because
I didn't propose this argument.
Right, but you have a very narrow, it seems like you have a very narrow and precise definition of an ethical person.
No, but let's see what other people say. Yeah, you brought it up. So what's your definition of an ethical person?
Let's see. I was thinking of my definition was going to be someone who kept the naturally negative precepts. who didn't perform naturally negative acts.
Okay, who didn't perform naturally negative acts. Okay. So it could be somebody who breaks precepts. Yeah.
Yes, yes.
Okay.
I have to have a definition. That's my definition.
But then it would follow that the definition of an ethical person is only someone who holds precepts from that. But you just said that then being unethical would be if you broke precepts. So then that follows that then to be an ethical person you would have to be holding precepts.
That isn't what I said. I said an ethical person would be someone who didn't perform naturally negative acts.
Yeah. And so then I said it could be somebody
who breaks precepts.
Who breaks precepts? Because somebody could break precepts and still be an ethical person by her definition.
His Holiness eats cookies
at what?
His Holiness eats cookies at night.
His Holiness what?
He eats cookies
at night. Okay. Okay. So what's the comparison between people who don't do naturally negative actions and people who have precepts? 4P. Okay, go through them. So this is the thing of somebody's declaring 4P and you're saying you agree with them. So what are you going to do in the case in a debate like that? Okay. So she says they're 4P. You agree with her, so then what do you do in the debate?
Is it something that is both?
You start with posit something that is both, right?
Okay.
That's both a person who keeps precepts.
No.
And refrains from naturally negative actions. Right.
Okay.
Someone.
Yeah?
I've read about a Buddhist practitioner who never broke precepts. And so that means he wouldn't have done any negative acts. I'm trying to remember who that was. Who wouldn't even break the smallest precept.
Yeah, Atisha.
Atisha.
Yeah.
Atisha.
Yeah.
Okay.
There is someone, Atisha.
Okay.
Do we want to go through all the reasons?
Yeah, go.
He broke precepts, he got off his horse and he purified it right away.
So Lama Atisha is a person who kept ethical precepts because?
I think it wasn't him then, because that's right. But I'll say it was maybe Lama Tsongkhapa instead. Lama Tsongkhapa is a person who keeps ethical precepts because he has not performed any of the activities that went against his precepts, his bhikkhu precepts.
Only bhikshu precepts? And tantra precepts?
I'm going to say only those because that's the ones I was referring to.
Okay. So he's somebody who has precepts and who has not
transgressed them.
Yeah.
And I'm talking about his monastic precepts.
Okay.
Because actually I think it would be harder to defend some of the other ones.
Right, and then for the same reason, I guess, Lama Tsongkhapa is someone who did not engage in any naturally negative acts.
Correct.
Right.
Because he avoided, for example, naturally negative acts like killing, stealing, lying, sexual misconduct. In fact, even foregoing tantra in this lifetime to become realized in the bargain.
No, he didn't forego tantra in this lifetime.
Certain aspects of tantra in this lifetime to become more fully awakened in the bardo.
Okay, so then posit an example of someone who does not keep precepts, but refrains from naturally negative acts.
My friend Grace.
Who I don't know.
But I do.
Okay.
Okay, so your friend Grace
has no precepts but does not perform naturally negative acts. She doesn't have any precepts. but she does not perform natural negative acts.
Right, so she doesn't have any precepts, but how do I... This is a hard example, right?
You wanted me to give you an example of someone who does not perform naturally negative
acts. Yeah, but now you have to prove why grace is an example.
Give me a valid reason why. Because she doesn't hold any... She is not a religious practitioner and has no precepts. Okay. She has not adopted any precepts. And she has not performed naturally negative acts of killing, stealing...
She's never made a phone call at her company or bought something on her company's credit card or...
Not that I'm aware.
Right, Venerable Sulchim. She said, it follows that Grace has never told a white lie.
Is a white lie naturally negative act? I guess so. Not that I'm aware.
Okay, then posit someone who does keep precepts but has committed a naturally negative action.
Somebody. I would say that any religious practitioner of any tradition who has taken precepts and has use their position to influence others, such as having stealing from them or having sexual favors from them or anything like that, because those are naturally negative acts. For instance, there are a number of practitioners of the Buddhist faith, of the Catholic faith, of the almost every faith you hear about that have precepts and have performed naturally negative acts. Mm-hmm. I don't want to list any names.
But that's somebody who... We haven't gone through... That should be the last one, shouldn't it?
Well, that's the one who doesn't
either. Yeah, that's the one that's neither. Which one are you asking about?
There has precepts.
Yeah, so we did both, right? Then we did has no precepts but naturally negative. Has refrained from naturally negative acts but has no precepts.
Then that's grace.
Yeah.
And then somebody
who has precepts but has not refrained from naturally negative acts. Yeah, so that's the religious practitioner who has...
The wayward priest.
Wayward priest.
Priest.
Right? Wayward monk or nun.
And then?
Please posit someone who is neither, who does not have ethical precepts and has not refrained from... Is it? Who has not refrained from...
Me, when I was...
Oh, it could be anything.
Yeah. Me, when I was 15 years old.
Okay. So that's good. In the debate, what you do is you have to go through and state why.
Right.
You know, you give an example, and then you run through why is it this one and why is it that one? Why is it this one? Why is it not that one?
Right. And so for the last one, I could say, when I was 15 years old, I did not hold any, I didn't have any precepts because I hadn't at that point, I had no religion. Mm-hmm. And when I was 15 years old, I performed naturally negative acts because I'm sure I must have stolen something. Maybe. Oh, I know. Maybe when I was 21, I stole a stop sign. A road sign with a bunch of friends. We went out in my pickup and pulled a sign right out of the ground, and I came home with it. Very stupid.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So let's do some more and go through the thing where you have to say why it's this one and not that one. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, how do the two compare? Relying on a spiritual mentor and seeing the guru as Buddha, or seeing the spiritual mentor as Buddha?
Wait, say that again.
Relying on a spiritual mentor. So the practice of relying on a spiritual mentor,
mm-hmm.
and the practice of seeing the spiritual mentor as a Buddha, how do they compare?
Mm. Okay. Hmm? You say 3P?
That's not 3P. Posit something that is both.
Something that is, there is something, the subject, a tantric practitioner who views their tantric master as the Buddha.
Okay. So why is that a practice of relying on a spiritual mentor?
Because you rely, that person, that practitioner relies on their spiritual mentor for guidance and inspiration in their practice.
And why is it a practice of seeing the spiritual mentor as a Buddha?
Because it's a tantric practice.
So it follows that all tantric practices involve seeing the spiritual mentor as a Buddha?
No. Ones that involve the spiritual mentor do, but there are tantric practices that don't involve the spiritual mentor. For example, a deity meditation.
But you do the deity meditation because a spiritual mentor gave you the empowerment.
But while you're doing the actual meditation, you're not reflecting on your spiritual mentor. Yes, it's true, you have that practice because of them.
Yeah. But you see the spiritual mentor as the deity.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Posit, so which way does the pervasion go?
Whatever is seeing the your teacher as the Buddha is relying on the spiritual mentor. If something is seeing your teacher as the Buddha, it necessarily is an act of relying on a spiritual mentor.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, well, to go through that, why?
Why?
Mm-hmm.
Because the act of seeing your teacher as a Buddha involves a spiritual mentor, and spiritual mentors, by definition, are someone who is relied upon by their disciple.
Mm-hmm. Maybe instead of the practice, it's better to say the person, you know, a person who relies on a spiritual teacher and a person who sees the spiritual teacher mm-hmm. as the Buddha. Maybe it's better,
yeah,
it's easier
different.
To do it as persons. Okay. And so, yeah, so mm-hmm. continue on.
And okay, so it follows that whoever sees their spiritual mentor as a Buddha is necessarily a person who relies upon the spiritual mentor, but whoever relies on a spiritual mentor does not necessarily see their spiritual mentor as a Buddha.
I think it's actually 4P now that it's a person.
mm-hmm.
Yeah, because it's no longer the act. Yeah, so I don't know if you want to change that.
Yeah,
no.
And then go through it.
Okay.
Do you think it's 4P or do you think it's 3P?
I think it's 4P.
Mm-hmm. Okay, then if you think it's what the other person said, then you go through together and you see.
Okay. So we've done sinless both. A person who sees the spiritual mentor as a Buddha, but is not a person who relies on the spiritual mentor.
There is someone, a young child who is taught by his parents that His Holiness is a Buddha, but knows nothing about practice, Buddhist practice.
Does that child I guess you could say the kid sees the guru as the Buddha. Okay.
Okay. And give an example of someone who relies on the spiritual mentor but does not see the spiritual mentor as a Buddha.
A practitioner in the Theravadan tradition.
Mm-hmm.
So why is that? Why is a practitioner of the Theravada tradition a person who relies on the spiritual mentor?
because they, in their tradition, teachings are passed down from spiritual mentor to disciple, stemming back to the Buddha.
So it follows that solitary realizers are not practitioners of the Theravada because they do not rely on a spiritual mentor in that life?
They have in the past. So.
And it follows that. Oh, no, sorry. And so, why is a practitioner of the Theravada not someone, not a person who sees a spiritual mentor as a Buddha?
Because that practice is not traditionally taught in that tradition.
So it follows that Ananda did not, or it follows that practitioners who were of the Theravada, you could say that were alive at the time of the Buddha, did not see the Buddha as a Buddha?
The Theravada tradition did not exist at the time of the Buddha.
The beginnings of it did.
I accept.
Posit something that's neither.
A follower of Jim Jones. A former follower.
Oh, but maybe he saw the guru's Buddha. Oh, but he didn't think about Buddha, did he? No. Okay.
How do the two compare? Prostrations, someone who prostrates to the Buddha, and someone who pays respect to the Buddha.
Okay, so you two debate then. She says 3P, you say 4P, then what are you going to say to her?
Which way does the pervasion go?
Whoever prostrates to the Buddha necessarily pays respect to the Buddha, I believe.
It follows that someone who comes on sharing the Dharma Day and prostrates out of, because they are just following the group but they have no clue what they are doing, is paying respect to the Buddha?
They are. Because the act that they are mimicking is an act of respect.
It follows that the fly that went around the stupa three times was paying respect to the Buddha. The fly and a piece of dung that was swept by water and wound up circumambulating a stupa was paying respect to the Buddha.
The fly is not a person who prostrates. So.
I know. Wait, let's go back to your reason. So a person who prostrates is necessarily paying respect to the Buddha because?
Because the prostration act is pervaded by an act of respect. Whatever is a prostration is necessarily an act of respect.
No, we're comparing people,
okay,
aren't we?
Well, that's my reason.
Whoever prostrates to the Buddha, the act of prostrating to the Buddha is necessarily an act of respect for the Buddha.
Mm-hmm.
Is that true or not true? Yeah. Is whatever an act of respect? Is whatever a prostration an act of not an act, but paying respect? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It follows that when I prostrate and I'm thinking about eating a burger, I'm paying respects to a Buddha.
That's what she's saying. Yeah, are you saying that? Do you agree with that?
It follows that it's not the mental state of respect that is paying respects, but actually a physical action that you're defining as respect.
Yes, that's true. Because the person who is prostrating, they are consciously engaging in an act of respect.
It follows that if a two-year-old mm-hmm. prostrates, kneels, and crawls towards the Buddha, is engaged in an act of respect towards the Buddha.
The prostrating part, but not the crawling.
I think I've seen on YouTube or somewhere that people can train their dogs to prostrate before the Buddha. So it follows that dogs who have been trained for treats to bow before a Buddha are paying respect to the Buddha.
I accept. It follows that the act carries within it.
The act of prostration is inherently an act of respect. It's an inherently existent act of respect.
It's conventionally an act of respect.
If it's conventionally an act of respect, then it must depend on other circumstances.
Yes, it does.
So what other circumstances that make it either virtuous or non-virtuous? Well, you're saying it's virtuous. That just the act of bowing is virtuous, is an act of respect.
One of the things it depends upon is a sentient being doing it.
So if it's dependent, then it can't be an inherently existent act.
Mm. That's conventionally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But in order to say that the physical action of bowing is an act of respect, the only way you can do that is to say it's an inherently existent one that doesn't depend on any other circumstances, because we've been giving absurd examples, and you keep saying that that they're all acts of respect. So you think that there's something in the physical action that makes it respectful.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I'm saying if there's something in the physical action itself, then it's got to be inherently existent. Because if it depends on any other factors, then sometimes it may not be inherently existent.
You are correct. I am defeated or whatever.
Okay, but then explain the little fly that went around the Buddha
mm-hmm.
on the little pile of poop.
they say that depends. Well, it's true. They do say that any contact with a holy object puts imprints of virtue on the mind. But that's always sounded to me like it's almost inherently existent. Personally, I've always had a bit of trouble with saying that. It's the power of the holy object. But I'm saying, what does, you know? Yeah, you have to imbue it with that meaning. And then you get into, I don't know, I've always had trouble with that, that just the action alone, independent of any other condition. Yeah. Puts a virtuous imprint, you know. But because, I mean, well, you know, you have the fly going around the stupa, you know. Is it, if it went the wrong way around the stupa? What makes the right way and what makes the wrong way of going around a stupa? Huh?
Yeah, Venerable Kunga's argument would be valid with the reason that not the reason that prostration in and of itself is inherently virtuous, but prostration to the Buddha is necessarily virtuous, I guess, not
because it's contact with a holy object.
Yeah, it's two different things.
Yeah, that's true. So it might be something virtuous, but it's not necessarily an act of paying respect. Yeah, because paying respect is done with the mind. I mean, it's the mind is the key thing that makes something paying respect. But does that mean when she's prostrating and she's thinking of tofu, don't you dare think of a burger. A tofu burger, okay. And she's thinking of a tofu burger, okay. Does that mean that there's no virtue in her mind?
Maybe not at the moment, but it happened to me sometimes that I do it automatically, and then when I sit and I think about it, there's regret, and so it's not during the moment, but after.
Right. Or it could be that even before, you have the intention to pay respect, and then right away you get distracted.
Mm-hmm. Just to clarify, not to commit an act of lying, I don't think about burgers when I'm prostrating to the Buddha.
Yes.
I don't think of anything. I just say I don't think about burgers.
Okay. Well, you clearly did because you gave that example.
You know? I was just thinking maybe the thing to compare here is push-ups and prostrations. Because art teachers like you would recommend, this is not exercise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what about doing a push-up in front of a Buddha statue? Is that virtue?
I mean, that's something that I suppose you could say is both, because Geshe Dadu, I don't remember exactly what he does, but it's 108 push-ups or a lot of push-ups that he does and dedicates them to the long life of His Holiness.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's try and stay within the debating structure. We're getting a little bit spaced out here. Okay. Somebody have two things? Or somebody make a statement. Somebody make a statement. And then, if you have, make a statement about something. And
compare.
No, don't not how do the two compare. Make a statement and then have the other person figure out how you're seeing it and then figure out how they're seeing it and then have the discussion with you. Are you getting what I'm saying?
Yeah, I am. I just have to do it open book because that's the only way I can do it. Venerable Kunga. It follows that yogic direct perceivers are mental direct perceivers.
I accept.
Okay.
I accept.
It follows that yogic direct perceivers are mental direct perceivers because?
Because of being a mental consciousness.
So you just made a statement. What was your initial statement?
It follows that yogic direct perceivers are mental direct perceivers.
Are mental direct perceivers. Okay. And so she said,
because they're a mental consciousness. They're a direct perceiver that is a mental consciousness.
In this system, are yogic direct perceivers and mental direct perceivers, am I?
No.
Okay, but she said.
Would you say that yogic direct perceivers are pervaded by mental direct perceivers?
Yes.
Then why? What state your reason why?
So yogic direct perceiver is a mental direct perceiver because it is a mental direct perceiver. It's a direct perceiver of a mental consciousness. And is not a direct perceiver of any of the sense consciousnesses.
Mm-hmm. So in this school, yeah, are yogic direct perceivers and mental direct perceivers, are yogic direct perceivers mental direct perceivers? When do mental direct perceivers occur in the Satantrika school?
The moment after sense perception.
Okay, so then according to you, it pervades that the moment that I, after I see yellow, that mental consciousness is a yogic direct perceiver.
No, it's a mental direct perceiver, mm-hmm. but it's not a yogic direct perceiver, okay. because yogic direct perceivers are only one subset of mental direct perceivers.
She's saying there are three.
No, but you just said what mental direct perceivers are. The definition is the moment in the mind right after a sense consciousness. So
that was an example. No.
Okay. So then, what's the definition of a mental direct perceiver according to Satantrika?
A mental consciousness that directly apprehends its object of comprehension.
Is that the definition? No, what's the definition?
Like the definition of mental direct perceivers are the unmistaken non-conceptual knower that arises from its own uncommon empowering condition, a mental sense power. So it follows that a yogic direct perceiver's uncommon empowering condition is a mental sense power. Is that what you're saying? Right? So it follows that a yogic direct perceiver's uncommon empowering condition is not a meditative stabilization that is a union of serenity and insight?
Okay. Can you repeat what you said?
It follows that a yogic direct perceiver's uncommon empowering condition is not a meditative stabilization that is a union of serenity and insight. Right? Because you're saying that its uncommon empowering condition is a mental sense power.
Yes. Why? I mean...
Right, so now she's saying that the meditative stabilization that is a union of serenity and insight is a mental sense power. Is that what you're positing?
Yes.
Then what do you say?
Isn't a mental sense power... What? The previous moment of... I posit the definition of a mental sense power.
No, you just gave it.
A mental sense power is a mind that is an immediately preceding condition of the empowering condition of its own... uncommon effect, a mental consciousness. See, to me it seems like it's possible that it would work.
Say that again.
A mental sense power, this is from the UMA dictionary.
Uh-huh. But we don't know if they're talking about Satantrika or Prasangika.
Yeah, well, that's the only place I found it.
Okay. Because I think, according to Prasangika, I think you could say that a yoga direct perceiver is a mental direct perceiver. However, according to Satantrika, you can't say that.
So in that would mean in Satantrika, when they divide direct perceivers into four, that those are all mutually exclusive if you compared one to the other?
Yeah, I think so, aren't they?
It seems then what is the, is it that the yogic direct perceiver can only occur in the continuum of an arya? Is that the different?
Mm-hmm. According to Satantrika, yes. According to Prasangika, no.
No, because just based on what Venerable Thapa was saying, you're right, it sounds like how do the two compare? A meditative stabilization that is a union of serenity and insight and the mental sense power. Could be 3P?
The mental sense power? No, the mental consciousness.
No, the mental sense power. Yeah.
Mental sense power. Those include sense consciousnesses.
Oh. Right. Yeah, so they with the meditative stabilization that is a union of serenity and insight, mm-hmm. be 3P with mental sense powers. Would they? Because
having
it's
a previous moment, a mind that is
I think my understanding is that they really separate out having empowering condition being the union of serenity and insight. Yeah, that's a completely different kind of empowering condition than just a previous moment of mental consciousness. Yeah.
On page 223, Dam Purdue says, the most important type of direct perceivers are yogic direct perceivers, a kind of mental direct perceiver that is a non-conceptual direct realizer of such profound objects as subtle impermanence and selflessness.
Okay. Now, I wonder, does somebody have the usual low-rig text? Yeah, because that would be true according to Prasangika. But I'm questioning if it's true according to Satantrika.
I mean, the usual Lauric text divides direct perceivers into four.
Yeah.
Right? Sense, mental, apperceptive, yogic.
Right.
So it would be that self-knowers and yogic direct perceivers are actually a subset of mental direct perceivers, even though they split direct perceivers into four. The last two, which are self-knowers and yogic direct perceivers, are actually subcategories of mental direct perceivers.
Yeah, just check it in the book. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, check it in the book and make sure. Well, I think if you go and find the place where they're talking about direct perceivers and the division. Okay, well, you could read it and then come tell us later. So, somebody have another statement they want to make?
The simple one that I got corrected on when I went to Stanford. So all people who practice Zen meditation are Buddhists. That's my assumption.
Ah, okay. Yeah.
Oh, is it Thomas Merton?
Is it
Buddhist?
Yeah. Why? Oh yeah, because he practices Zen meditation, I asserted the pervasion.
But this is an interesting question, okay? Because many people say, oh, you can practice Zen meditation without being a Buddhist. You know, there's that kind of natural assumption in society. But is that true? Yeah. Is it still Zen meditation if it's not practiced from a Buddhist perspective? Is Zen meditation the technique of focusing on your ara? What's it called? Focusing your hara. Is Zen meditation, you know, the technique, or is Zen meditation something that brings a certain kind of realization? A particular realization.
Yeah, I brought this up because the president of the Stanford Zen Buddhist group, who I totally assumed was a Buddhist, turned out to be an Orthodox Jew. That's what that's his identification. But he does koan practice and now is doing something related to the hara. So I was like, oh, whoops.
Yeah, so it's coming back to a question of what is Zen meditation? That's what I meant. Is it the technique? Or is it a meditation that leads to a specific Buddhist result? Yeah, which is it?
The one that leads to a certain result.
Mm-hmm. So what would you say to that guy? Who's the Orthodox Jew, who's the president of the Zen?
He's practicing techniques that were taught by the Buddha, uh-huh. and are practiced in the Zen tradition, but that doesn't necessarily mean that he's a Buddhist, but by right. practicing them.
Right, but is he doing Zen meditation?
No.
But he thinks he's doing Zen meditation. Yeah. So are you going to go up to him and say you're not doing Zen meditation? Or are you going to let him continue to think that he's doing Zen meditation? Depends on what? Okay. So what's a situation in which it would be beneficial not to tell him?
If he's experiencing a lot of benefit from doing the technique, and if telling him that he's no longer doing, if he's not doing Zen meditation, would it deter him from continuing doing it?
Mm-hmm. Okay. And what's a situation where you would tell him? But maybe he's just teaching Zen meditation. So is that okay? Can a non-Buddhist teach Zen meditation? She says no, you say yes.
Couldn't teach it marketing it as, like, saying it's Zen meditation. You could say you teach techniques that are from the Zen tradition, or explaining more clearly the kind of, like,
so what do you think about that?
My first Zen instruction have been from a Christian priest, and the techniques helped. So he taught us certain techniques, including walking meditation, but there was no reference to the Buddha.
Yeah. And so did you learn Zen meditation?
I learned aspects of Zen meditation, but not the full. What I received later in Japan was more, there have been more aspects to meditation, mm-hmm. including taking refuge.
So, yeah. So then this is an interesting question. Do you have to have all those circumstances together to learn Zen meditation? It's learning one aspect of Zen meditation, learning Zen meditation. Or do you have to learn many aspects of it, including taking refuge, for example?
Taking refuge. So there's certain, I think only certain masters would know the entirety of the techniques that would come under Zen meditation, mm-hmm. and that's not necessary for someone to be doing Zen meditation. However, mm-hmm. the aspects of, to make it a Buddhist practice, if we're mm-hmm. seeing Zen meditation as a Buddhist practice, you necessarily have to be taking refuge.
Mm-hmm. But this is part of the question. Do you have to see Zen meditation as a Buddhist practice?
I learned to do meditation from a book called The Three Pillars of Zen, written by a Zen monk, mm-hmm. and I had no idea about refuge.
Mm-hmm.
And yet I was doing the practice, but I didn't have the worldview.
Yeah. So were you doing Zen meditation?
I don't know. I've been thinking about that, because my intention was to try to work with my mind with an ultimate goal of working towards liberation. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's where I wonder if, is something Buddhist meditation because it leads to enlightenment, or is it a Buddhist practice because somebody has the motivation to gain enlightenment?
I don't think it would be Zen meditation unless it follows within the structure of the tradition that is called Zen.
So you would say it would have to be Buddhist.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or to be Zen meditation.
Yeah. Can you aim for liberation if you're not quite clear what liberation is? Did you understand what liberation was when you read the book?
Very vaguely. Vaguely compared to the teachings that I've received here.
Yeah.
There was, it was mostly sit and watch your mind, let go what you think you know, and it will dawn on you.
So can you seek liberation without knowing what having any idea really about what liberation is?
I think so, because can you seek wisdom without having the wisdom, without knowing what it is?
Yeah, but don't you have to, can you go to Delhi without knowing anything about what Delhi is? If I say, go to Delhi.
Yeah, but going to Nirvana is leaving samsara. And yeah, so you could have the...
But you have no idea what Nirvana and samsara are. So can you aim for Nirvana? Can you aspire to get rid of samsara if you have no idea of what it is? Can you, if I say go to Delhi and you drive down to the shopping center and get a corned beef for that? And you say, I went to Delhi. Okay, so with that, we better conclude. But what are you learning from this kind of discussion?
We have definitions
here. What?
Early in the debate, you have to be really clear that your definitions are where they are, what they are, and how your definitions compare.
Right. Yeah. You have to be very sure at the beginning that you have a common understanding of what each word means. Yeah, because if you don't have that, you can't compare things. Yeah.
Or you tease it out.
Yeah, or you tease it out. You know, but this is why they have you memorize the definitions. And then you may memorize the definition but not really understand it very well. And then that can come out during the debate. Because somebody says, well, it is Zen meditation. Somebody else says it isn't. And so what's the definition of Zen meditation? Yeah. And so then you have to go and, I mean, really figure it out. So it's, you know, when you're studying within a system that has, where they give you the definitions, then you just have to remember the definitions and kind of figure out what they mean. But so much of our ordinary conversation, we think everybody has the same definition, but they don't. Yeah? I mean, right now, the big conversation is, what is the definition of an impeachable offense? Yeah? What makes something an impeachable offense? And this is what the whole thing is about. Yeah?
This was directed toward a certain person, a certain amount of people would say, we know exactly what an impeachable offense is.
Mm-hmm.
And if it was somebody else, that group of people may say, that's not an impeachable offense. So not only is the definition, but there's an object in which it's referring who did the action that is.
But if you have a specific definition, then it wouldn't depend on who you were putting it on. It would have to be, you know.
So what we're seeing now is there's a flaw. There is not a clear definition that everybody can agree on.
Exactly. Yeah, there's not a clear definition.
Not established that the justice system in this country applies definitions equally to all.
Yeah, and it's also that even the justice system itself, you know, what is it? High crime and misdemeanor. People are not clear about what that means. What's a high crime? You have to be up near the ceiling to do it? you know?
Or light bulbs.
Right. Yeah, right. Okay, so, you know, we got you for stealing light bulbs. You know, move out of the White House. Okay. But you can see that really this is, you know, one of the big things of what actually constitutes an impeachable offense. Yeah. And it's interesting because you can tell people are coming up with all sorts of different definitions of impeachable offense now, you know, as the Republicans are trying to get out of it. Yeah, it's becoming quite obvious by the testimony that, you know, these things were done, although there is some debate about it. But let's say you accept that these things were done. There's still a lot of discussion about, is that an impeachable offense? You know, and one person says, you know, well, everybody does it in all political states. McMulvaney says, get over it. Everybody does that. Okay, so does everybody does that, is that a reason to make an action not an impeachable offense if you have a set definition? No, it's not. Okay. So, but, you know, to look, it's very interesting. There was one article about 22, that stated 22 arguments that the Republicans are using to say that it's not an impeachable offense. And somebody should try and find that article and then go through it using the debating techniques. Yeah? And see how it fits to, you know, the different reasons why they're saying something is not an impeachable offense. So what, how is all of that shaping what an impeachable, you know, there's one thing. Yeah, impeachable, we're creating the definition, okay? And then, are we trying to change the definition as we learn, get more evidence? Yeah? So, yeah, it'd be very interesting. Find that article and then go through and see, yeah, what are the criteria that people are giving to that action. And if you define it in a certain way, what does that mean? Okay. Like, can parents be impeached? Can you impeach your parents? Yeah. There's one case of one boy who wanted to divorce his parents. Yeah. Can you impeach them? You know, it would be to really come up with a definition that's going to work across the board. You're going to have to think of things like that.
Also, you have to have people that are debating in good faith, and people are simply, this is what I want impeachable offense to mean.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And
yeah. So that's kind of like what Dan said here. Don't waste your time debating with somebody who isn't open to changing their mind or who has a specific set agenda that they don't want to budge from.
It seems like even if someone is someone you can talk with and debate with, there might be times when you just can't define things clear enough that for it to be a suitable subject.
Yeah. You found what? Oh, yeah, tell us. This is from what book?
This is from Lati Rinpoche's book, Mind in Tibetan
okay.
Buddhism. So
mm-hmm.
when they divide mental direct perceivers, there's ones that are indicated on this occasion and not indicated on this occasion. Mm-hmm. So in this one, I'm just going to read this one paragraph.
Read it slowly.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mental, I know, that's what I wondered, but this might have answered it, the question more directly. Mental direct perceivers indicated on this occasion take as their objects only the five sense objects. Those mental direct perceivers which take phenomena here, meaning those which are only objects of the mental consciousness, such as subtle impermanence, as their objects are yogic direct perceivers, and as such are mental direct perceivers, but not those indicated on this occasion.
Okay, so there you have
so
it.
They are mental direct perceivers, but not those indicated on this
so
occasion.
So if they're not indicated on this occasion, that means they're not the mental direct perceivers spoken about on that occasion.
There are mental direct perceivers that are indicated on this occasion and ones that are not indicated on this occasion. I'll have to go back and read that.
Yeah,
part.
So does that mean when they're not indicated on that occasion?
That's a whole class. And that class is... So you're
just talking about clairvoyance, and it's not an exhaustive list. I remember
you. Yeah. When we studied this, I remember very clearly that mental direct perceivers were divided into... it included self-knowing direct perceivers and mm-hmm. yogic direct perceivers, but mm-hmm. I'll find you a quote because I don't have my computer here.
Those okay. are the ones that are indicated on this
Asian.
Which
maybe,
ones?
Maybe.
Maybe.
Yeah, I don't know. I have to read more. I didn't find
yeah,
that
No,
part.
But my question is if you say they're not indicated on this occasion.
That's one of
does
the two
that,
divisions
it,
of
does
mental.
That make it a division of mental direct perceivers? Or does that mean that it's not a direct mental direct perceiver because it's not one that's indicated on this occasion. It's one that's indicated on some other occasion in some other textbook or
no, it's,
something.
No, it's dividing.
Yeah, what I'm asking is what does not indicated on this occasion mean?
Right, and that's what I'm trying to find for
okay.
you, because it's a division of mental direct perceivers.
Okay, but what does it mean? What differentiates indicated and not indicated on this occasion?
The main one that's being talked about there is the one that comes at the end of a sense direct perceiver.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's indicated on that occasion. What's also included that's not indicated on that occasion is clairvoyance, different types of clairvoyance.
Okay.
But that's not an exhaustive list. It also would include self-knowing yeah. direct perceivers and
but the first sentence she read was a mental direct perceiver
is divided into two.
No. What's the first sentence that the definition?
That's the problem. Is we're picking it up in the middle of something and it already divided into those two and that's the part I can't find.
Yeah, we need to find the definition before they divide it into two.
Well, we need to find the definition
yeah.
of both of those, indicated
yeah.
on this occasion and not indicated.
And not indicated, and the one for both things. Because just because something has a name doesn't mean it is a subcategory of something.
Right. That's
yeah.
right, and that's why I've been wondering about this.
Yeah, please. So we need to do more research.
Okay. Yeah.
And see if we could figure out, okay, what's the difference between indicated on this occasion and not?
Mm-hmm.
And why would they make that distinction?
Right.
Yeah, what's
yeah.
the purpose of making that
yeah.
distinction?
I'd have to have time to read this. Can't do it while
yeah.
I'm sitting here. It's a very complicated
okay.
topic.
Emphasis. You know, they all, you know, like this, they all, there's four branches, but actually three of them are part of the first one, okay? But they separate them out for emphasis. Then in other things, there's four branches, and the branches are mutually exclusive, even though they have the same name. Yeah? So this is what's often tricky. Yeah. And that shows how often we don't really understand the definition, you know? Yeah.
I'd like to have it affirmed saying yes
it is,
but.
Yeah.
I really
right. Yeah. Because if, you know, we can know, oh, well, the book says these are all four, you know, our types of men. But then when we come to why, that part, you know, we don't really know. We know what the book says, but do we understand what is happening?
The definition of a mental direct perceiver is a non-mistaken, non-conceptual knower that arises from its own uncommon empowering condition, a mental sense power. So the mental sense power is whichever of the six consciousnesses has it needed to be perceived. And, you know, so you could make the case that yogic direct perceiver arises from the consciousness that perceives it, which happens to be a unit of common body special insight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but you could probably, you know, you could make that argument, but they, you know, are they separating out yogic direct perceiver because there's something that doesn't exactly fit that definition, or because they just want to emphasize it?
Because they're very important. We only have them on the path.
Mm-hmm.
When you read the yogic definition of yogic perceiver, I was following the truth on that.
Mm-hmm. Because I just remember somewhere them talking about, you know, how it's a completely different kind of empowering condition. Yeah. Its own empowering condition, yeah. Yeah. Anyway, let's keep researching this and see what we find.